Hello, fellow realists. I'm David Ravel, and this is ValueSign for the weekend. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit valuesign.com. Well, today, election and inflation. What a week. It was a remarkable week in the stock market. Everything turned around on Thursday with the release of the latest inflation reading. The Consumer Price Index revealed that inflation was only running at 7.7%. This completely blindsided Wall Street. Literally no one expected this 50 basis point drop in inflation. It opened up all kinds of possibilities for investors, including the possibility that the Fed's high interest rate policy might be working, and we may be able to exit this restrictive condition sooner rather than later. Well, whatever their rationale, traders took to their terminals to spark the most significant rally in weeks. This was also the week of the midterm elections, with hundreds of offices up for grabs around the country. Initial reports indicated a win for the Democrats, but as those late tabulating ballots rolled in, it doesn't appear to be the case. It looks like the Republicans will take control of the House of Representatives and have a better-than-even chance to take over the Senate. At the statewide level, a bellwether state, North Carolina, appears much redder this year, and there's a possibility that both Arizona and Nevada may see gains for the GOP. So all in all, a closer contest than predicted, but at the end of the day, it looks like Republicans, not Democrats, will have gained the most. For us, it was a busy week. Time to discuss such issues as the problem with guidance, an economic review of the latest Congress, and the incredible decline of cryptocurrencies, one of the most significant market crashes of all time. So sit back, grab a cup of coffee as we look at the week just passed. Sometimes the world seems so strange that it's hard to imagine what's really happening. There is a grave deception taking place in our society, a sleight of hand that occurs nearly every day. It's the reason you often say to yourself, "I don't understand this," or "this doesn't make sense." Suppose you feel that way at times, it's because you're being misled, and increasingly, it's intentional. Let me illustrate. Currently, the World Series is playing. As any baseball fan will tell you, on Thursday night, the Houston Astros beat the Philadelphia Phillies by a score of 3-2. Pooh. We all saw the game, or at least heard about it, and we likely don't need anyone to tell us what happened. It was straightforward enough. The Phillies lost. But that's not how it works in the financial world. Somehow, we got it in our heads, or more likely, we've been convinced that seeing something isn't enough. We need to have it explained. What happened? Someone will need to tell us exactly how the Astros won and what it all means. Enter the Wall Street analyst, the financial press, the pundits, and other members of the chattering class. These are the people whose job is to offer their opinion. They tell us how and why things are going on in finance. Incidentally, finance isn't alone in having members of the chattering class, as English journalist Aberton Waugh coined the term more than 50 years ago. Imagine that the chattering class was to report on Game 3 of this year's World Series. Their reporting would go something like this. First, the chatterers would estimate the game's outcome ahead of time. Something like, "We've cranked up our computer models, input all the data, and we're now estimating that the Phillies will be shut out. They won't score a single run, and the Astros will win 5-0. Flash forward to the game. Now, as we know, the final score in Game 3 was Phillies 2, Astros 3, in a tight, nail-biter game. Here's how the chatterers would now describe that game. "Philadelphia outdid themselves, scoring much higher than we expected. It was a marvelous performance by the Phils, who are hitting above their average for the series and seem destined to perform well in the upcoming Game 6 of the World Series." Now see how it works? After reading that report, are you confused about just what did happen? Still trying to figure out who the real victor was? Of course! And that's the fundamental objective of the Chatterers. For those who believe this doesn't happen in the real world, I present the payroll report from Friday. Each month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics provides this survey of the number of new workers placed on company payrolls. It's one of the most authoritative reports on the performance of the labor market. Along with unemployment, these make up the two most closely watched views of workers in this country. Now, these two reports represent a critical benchmark of our political leaders' labor policies. At a glance, we can look at the payroll and unemployment reports and tell that the demand for workers is either getting better or worse. So here's how the Chatterers describe the payroll report on Friday. Quote, the U.S. economy added a stronger than expected 261,000 new jobs in October. Well, who was expecting? Why, it's the chattering class, of course, that was expecting. Now remember, this is how the process works. First, the chatterers have provided a lowball estimate, one that's easily exceeded. They can then tout that the Phillies beat expectation, an expectation that the chatterers set themselves, not something that's real, something that never happened before and will never happen again. Chatterers' expectations are pure fantasy. But in Friday's report, you would think they were real, when they're not. Again, the comment, repeated in all the press reports of the day, was, quote, the U.S. economy added a stronger-than-expected 261,000 new jobs in October, unquote. Sounds great, doesn't it? Sounds like the economy is humming right along. There is nothing to worry about here. Give those politicians up in Washington a pat on the back. Their policies must be working. Well, hold on a minute. Here's reality. The payroll report on Friday was the worst, by far, of any of the reports this year. That 261,000 new jobs added was 54,000 less than the month before. It was also 40% less than the average number of new jobs added each month this year. This payroll report wasn't simply dismal. It was a disaster. And if anyone thinks this report reflects a more robust economy, you're sadly mistaken. This report is a reflection of an economy that is declining precipitously and of a labor market that is hitting the skids. The labor sector isn't getting healthier, it's getting sicker. If you would like more confirmation, please look over at the unemployment rate. Unemployment rate just jumped from 3.5% to 3.7%. That represents a rise of over 300,000 in the newly unemployed. Now, you don't need the chatterers to explain this to you. You don't need to work yourself into a pretzel trying to figure out how unemployment rises while payrolls look just fine. The answer is, payrolls were not favorable. And these two reports, payroll and unemployment, are perfectly consistent. Payrolls declined, unemployment rose, just as you would expect. Now, the chatterers who are helping you don't understand this. They're hoping to obscure what happens. Here's the bottom line. This was the worst payroll report of the year, combined with the worst unemployment. Bad news for labor, and bad news for those political incumbents who try to tout their economic policies. Does that sound like a stronger-than-expected economy? Oh, and by the way, the Astros still won on Thursday, 3-2. Well, on January 3rd, 2021, 100 senators and 435 representatives began the 117th United States Congress. 2 weeks later, Joseph Biden was sworn in as the 46th president. Today, we the voters have the opportunity to decide whether they have been successful in guiding our diverse country over these last couple of years. Today, one-third of the Senate and all of the House of Representatives will stand for election. While each candidate may have their preferred project or issue, we will look at the pocketbook issues. We'll take an objective look at the big economic picture. Now, James Carville, then President Bill Clinton's campaign manager, famously said that in all elections, it's the economy that determines the outcome. It's the economy, stupid, he replied, when asked what would win the presidential election that year. And his advice has been followed every year since, except this year. If you've noticed, most incumbents rarely mention the economy. They'll gladly talk to you about anything else, from climate change to health care. But it's almost impossible to get them to talk about this economy. And that should tell you all you need to know about the current monetary conditions. So let's step back and see how today's economy compares to what these senators and representatives inherited back on January 3rd, 2022. Now then, the nation was recovering from the COVID-19 economic lockdown. The economy had been through the shortest and deepest recession in our history. The fastest in that the recession lasted only a quarter. The deepest in that GDP recorded a nearly 30% decline in economic activity, at one point declining at the greatest rate since the Great Depression of the 1920s. And the cause of this abrupt recession? Well, it was lockdown. Lockdown was the policy of political leaders to close up any shop or business considered non-essential. It was these lockdowns that imploded the economy. Now, when the 117th Congress was sworn in, most of the volatility from that was behind us. The country survived both the economic crash and the subsequent economic boom. So on that early January day, the nation's GDP came in at 2.8%. Today, the economy is growing at nearly an identical pace. GDP showed last 2.6% growth. So no real change in economic growth over these past 2 years. However, it's an entirely different story when we get to inflation. Despite the economic roller coaster that the nation had been through, there was little inflation when 2021 began. The day the 117th Congress was sworn in, inflation stood at less than 2%. So weak was inflation back then that it was the Federal Reserve's policy to increase inflation. I know, that's hard to imagine. But all that began to change immediately upon these senators and representatives taking their seats. Those government stimulus checks that they all voted for began to have a predictable effect. Inflation took off like a rocket, from less than 2% on their inauguration to nearly 7% by the end of 2021. Who would have thought that printing money out of thin air might produce inflation? Well, our Congress people must have missed Econ 101, the part about more dollars chasing fewer goods and services being inflationary. So on inflation, this Congress and this president should get all the credit for inflation. And inflation has led to a very curious situation in our income and spending. We'll begin by looking at personal income. When the Congress began, the country's real personal income was $19.3 billion annually. Today, it's only $17.7 billion. However, unlike most other times I remember, this loss of real income is entirely due to the impact of inflation. Some may feel that their paycheck is the same, but after inflation is accounted for, they're actually losing purchasing power. That paycheck might read the same, but it won't buy as much. The other way to say that is that it costs more today to buy just about everything. So, and this is a great irony, people are spending more today than 2 years ago. Spending is up 7% in these last 2 years. Why? The answer is shortages, specifically shortages in the entire energy field, but especially in oil and gas. Gasoline has been the number one contributor to inflation these last 2 years. And these higher prices are due entirely to President Biden's anti-fossil fuel policies. You may have noticed that the president announced that he would now shut down the coal industry to add to all the rest. Another blow against energy supplies for the country. That should do wonders for those areas of the country that still rely on coal-powered electric generation. So real personal income is declining because of inflation. Private expenditures are increasing because of shortages, particularly energy shortages. And that's not good news for those of us who are average consumers. Now, the final economic measure we'll look at is the cost of finance. During these past 2 years of runaway inflation and energy shortages, this Congress and the President have done little to nothing to address the genuine inflation issues. Reducing government spending would go a long way in reducing inflation, but Washington is mum. Promoting fossil fuel production would go a long way in mitigating energy shortages and high prices. Fossil fuels, after all, represent more than 3/4 of the energy we use. But again, neither Congress nor this president want anything to do with carbon-based fuels. So the Federal Reserve is the quasi-governmental agency tasked with curing inflation. It is now the Fed's responsibility to slay the inflation dragon, and their only weapon seems to be interest rates. Interest rates have gone from 0.25% to 4% in the past 2 years, perhaps the most significant relative increase in interest rates ever. Higher interest is pure destruction of the demand side of this economy. Although we have seen some demand destruction already, especially in real estate, the full impact of these rate hikes will come next year. And that is the reason that many analysts on Wall Street are predicting a recession commencing by mid-2023. So that's a brief look at the economic record of the 117th Congress and the 46th President. It's been 2 years, highlighted by stimulus-driven inflation, energy shortages, and the loss of personal purchasing power. Something to think about when you're in that polling booth. Well, nearly 62 years ago, a young senator from Massachusetts was sworn in as the nation's 35th president. John F. Kennedy challenged the nation to look at government in a new light. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Now, for those who were around back then, it became a rallying cry for people who wished to achieve more in their public and private lives. It galvanized the country into a can-do initiative that called on each citizen to contribute more than they consumed to build a great nation through the contribution of everyone. Yesterday, many of us participated in one of the great civic traditions in this country. We voted. Elections are our quintessential duty and a privilege for us all. It provides the opportunity to vote for candidates of our choice. But perhaps equally as important, it puts the most critical issues before us. It is a chance to see the difference between competing political parties. What distinguishes one party from another? Today, the nation faces many challenges: the real threat of global war, the crisis in energy and food, and the problems of runaway inflation. Although we could mention many more, these four issues represent actual heartache for many. Global war, in particular, represents an existential threat to the country. Each day we come closer and closer to an all-out conflict over Ukraine. Just weeks from now, winter begins, and people worry that they won't be able to heat their homes. Early reports indicate that this year's harvest may fall short of projection. And of course, we are all suffering the effects of diminishing purchasing power. So during the election season, I thought I'd head over to the White House website to see how the president and his administration address these issues. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking of Kennedy's words about rugged individualism and how a nation of self-reliant individuals could deal with these current problems. We could be the country that promotes peace in Ukraine or provides abundant food and energy as we have done so many times in the past. And we could be the country that gets our financial house in order and ends our profligate spending. But if that were what I thought I'd see from this president, I was sadly mistaken. Peace, abundance, and frugality have no place in today's Democrat Party. At least if Joe Biden is its proper representative. Instead, looking at thewhitehouse.gov, you'll find the complete inversion of John Kennedy's sentiments. The White House headlines the front page of its website with four Build Back Better programs. The first is student loan debt relief, free COVID vaccines, free internet, called the Affordable Connectivity Program, and free access to abortion. It's a list that is a far cry from the challenge issued by President Kennedy so long ago. Biden has transformed the presidency into the candy man, asking, "What flavor would you like?" or a new motto of, "Just ask how your country can serve you." These sentiments are the complete reversal of the views of President Kennedy. Unfortunately, history will not likely allow Biden to merely pass out bonbons. Enlisting social programs may help bring out voters at election time, but they won't solve today's global issues. There are real challenges that we face. We risk a thermonuclear war with Russia, which has more nuclear weapons than we do. Reports from Ukraine last week indicated that there are already American boots on the ground in that country. Yet Biden has not appeared before Congress or the American people to explain his strategy in that beleaguered country. Why? What's his objective? Without diesel, this country grinds to a halt. Trucks and trains run on diesel. Without trucks and trains, nothing gets delivered. No food, no supplies, and no gasoline. Last week, there were reports that diesel stations were out of fuel in the South. Indications are that the diesel shortage will work its way up the East Coast shortly. And there's a looming threat of food shortages. The president could mitigate the problems of a low harvest by canceling overseas grain sales and transitioning corn to be used exclusively for food. And yet we continue to ship much of our food overseas and burn corn in our automobiles. It's called ethanol. It's incredible how far we've come as a nation in the 62 years since Kennedy. We've prospered like no other country in history. We've been blessed beyond measure with peace and prosperity. We've enjoyed bountiful harvest after bountiful harvest. However, as history teaches, someday that will end. Many indications are that this may happen this year, in which case it's time to end this government candyman mentality, to reach back and see what we can do for our country. Today is Inflation Day, that day when the economy's inflation rate is published. Our scorekeeper, as it is every month, is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, a little-known division of the Department of Labor. The BLS is mandated to keep accurate and timely records of the nation's employment and labor sector. And all the data we've used in today's podcast comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, the Bureau reports prices. The Consumer Price Index, or CPI, is the most closely watched of all inflation reports. The CPI affects everyone in the nation. It measures the cost of necessities, such as food, shelter, clothing, and energy. The Bureau calculates how much an average family needs to earn to enjoy a decent standard of living. Now, Americans have enjoyed a bountiful standard of living because of the 40-year convergence of both high productivity combined with low, stable prices. Not since the 1980s have people been worried about rising prices. Inflation simply has not been an issue. In fact, for most of that time, disinflation, or lower costs, were the top monetary conditions. Low-cost imports, chiefly from China and Southeast Asia, combined with new distribution channels, such as the big box stores and online shopping, created a bargain lover's paradise. It was a time of rising wages and salaries and falling prices that created one of the most significant economic booms of all time. But as we all know, those times are over. What was so remarkable was how quickly the good times ended. It was as if someone said, "The party's over," told the band to stop playing, and turned out the lights. We've never seen anything like it. When Paul Volcker was fighting inflation in the early 1980s, inflation had been building for years. Inflation began, at least, by the 1973 OPEC oil embargo, and worsened steadily. It was a decades-long march from beginning to climax. But not this time. This time, we've had instant inflation. No inflation before Biden. In the decade before Joe Biden was elected president, only 1 year did inflation exceed 2%. But instant inflation once Biden became president. Now, in 2021, things began to change. Inflation took off, as we've never seen before. By March 21, inflation had hit 2.6%. In April, inflation was at 4%, the highest rate of inflation in years. 5% inflation came just 2 months later in June, 6% by November, and 8% inflation by March of this year, where we've essentially been ever since. In an economy as massive and diverse as ours, it can be challenging to determine just what are the causes and effects. But I'm a numbers guy, and I go where the numbers lead, and in this case, it is apparent. For the first year of massive inflation under President Biden, the number one contributor to that was the cost of gasoline. Well, the cost of all oil and gas was driving inflation. But particularly gasoline, as noted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Food has only increased to the number one inflation contributor in the last couple of months. But gas is still number two and threatens to go much higher this winter, which would contribute to even more inflation. Now, once we've determined what's driving inflation, and that is the price of gasoline, it becomes relatively easy to decide on why. Did something change in the economy that contributed to these escalating prices? The answer is yes. Specific Biden policies radically altered the nation's energy policy and increased costs. On January 27, 2021, just a week after inauguration, President Biden signed two executive orders called the Climate Day Orders. These orders were sweeping in their impact, encompassing several of Biden's pet objectives. They committed the nation to join the Paris Accords on climate change. They closed down the Keystone XL pipeline and ordered a halt to all new oil and gas leases on federal lands, the most significant available land for oil exploration. As you can imagine, the price of oil started to climb as companies realized this was the end of the road for new petroleum sources. Because President Biden has been unswerving in his commitment to eliminate fossil fuels, he casually mentioned last week that he intended to close down all coal mines in the country soon. Perhaps the most dramatic gesture in Biden's effort to do away with carbon-based fuels was his executive order on March 8 of this year to halt all imports of Russian oil, gas, and coal. The executive order directly responded to Russians' incursion into Ukraine, but there can be no doubt that it also fulfilled Biden's green objectives. This EO removed about 10% of America's oil and gas supply and caused yet another bout of inflation. Now, the United States begins this winter with an uncertain energy position for the first time in memory. There is great concern that there won't be enough diesel to run the trucks and trains that supply most of the country's goods and products. Many are concerned that there won't be enough natural gas or heating oil to warm their homes here in the Northeast. And out West, many feel that they can no longer rely on electricity to supply their needs. Briefly, we're facing a universal shortage of energy. Now, the way that commercial markets solve any deficit is to simply raise the price. And that's why the cost of all energy products continue to rise. And those rising prices are what you and I call inflation.
Well,
What's happening in the crypto markets is simply stunning. Bitcoin, the most widely traded of all cryptos, has declined by an incredible 96% in just the last 6 months. It's one of the most significant financial crashes of all time. Now, it would be easy to dismiss this as simply a fad investment gone wrong, but that would be a mistake. Cryptos are the proverbial canary in the coal mine, to use a favorite expression of Wall Street. And just like the miner's canary, which warned that conditions in the mine were unsafe, cryptos are a harbinger of the future, indicating that something is very wrong in the global financial markets. And like the tiny canary, cryptos are likely the most vulnerable of investment vehicles. So this recent crash is sending a clear message that things have turned dire. This crash is all very reminiscent of the great financial crisis of 2008. The mortgage industry first felt the impending heat of a significant market decline. Major mortgage brokers like Countrywide Credit crashed back then, but many ignored their warning, feeling that this event was isolated and would never affect traditional investments such as stocks and bonds. They were wrong. The contagion from the mortgage-backed market eventually spread to the entire financial arena, not because the other markets, like traditional stocks and bonds, had any exposure to mortgages, but because the same disease that plagued mortgages also plagued stocks and bonds. And that disease is leverage. Our financial world rests upon a literal mountain of debt. Current household debt is $4.6 trillion. Corporate debt, $12.5 trillion, and the federal government has reached $30.5 trillion in debt. When times are good, these levels of debt may be no problem. Everything will be fine if the borrowers can make their interest payments and their collateral for those loans remains solid. The federal government does not have a credit issue. Its collateral is the entire country, and its cash flow derives from its unlimited ability to tax you and me. There are other issues with government debt, but we'll discuss those in another article. On the other hand, corporate and personal debt can have significant problems if they need more cash flow to make the debt payments or their collateral declines. In either case, there is the potential for default on their loans. So let's examine how this decline in the crypto markets may affect the financial system. Most who hold cryptocurrencies consider it money, cash, available to make purchases and to invest. And I'm not aware of anyone using cryptos as collateral, that is, take loans out against the crypto position, but I'm sure that everyone would include their crypto holdings in calculating their current net worth. And why not? Cryptos are an investment, just like any other. As cryptos increase in price, something called the wealth effect occurs. People, justifiably, felt that they were worth more and that they could spend more and invest more based on their appreciating crypto holdings. But today, the reverse of that is happening. Let's call it the poverty effect. Crypto holders realize they're worth a lot less today than they were in April. Naturally, they cut back on their spending and perhaps stop investing. If things get tight enough, they may withdraw financially entirely. Remember that these crypto investors don't live in a vacuum. Many carry other obligations, such as credit cards, mortgages, and other loans. Those bills still have to be paid. And if they're using cryptos to pay for those expenses today, then they must sell 10 times the Bitcoin, for instance, to make the same house payment as they needed to sell back in April. Selling begets selling. Undoubtedly, a sizable portion of the investment public invests in cryptos. If these people withdraw from investing, it's bound to impact the financial markets significantly. So here's today's message. The crypto crash may seem far away and removed, but it can spread like wildfire and affect us all. Just because we don't own cryptos, we should not feel immune from its effects. Our task today is to make our investments as fireproof as possible. And that's The Value Side for Friday, November 11th. For all of our articles, complete with charts and references, visit valueside.com. I'm David Revelle. ValueSide is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own.